Okay. Good morning, everybody. So thanks for having me speak on the new curriculum. This is what compromises most of my life these days. So who here has not heard me speak about the new curriculum? Okay, that's very good, because you won't be bored. The good thing is I've distilled this down to the very basics. So first of all, disclosures, I am the associate dean, so that could be construed as a conflict in talking about the new curriculum, because I have a vested interest in its success. And hopefully you will buy into that as well. Learning objectives are pretty simple. I want to describe a little bit about some of the principles that underline the framework of building the new curriculum, and have a little bit of opportunity for discussion about what that implications and the opportunities for the selection of medical students are through the admissions process. All right, so let's talk a little bit about curricular renewal. So to put this in perspective, the last major curricular renewal in McGill was in 1994, so that's 19 years ago. And these are some of the world events that have happened since 1994. And I'll let you read that. And I wonder if anybody has any comments about how either the world or medicine has changed in the last 19 years based on, obviously, a biased list that I have decided to put together. Or is it exactly the same? That's, somebody said that when... Right. So that's not specifically up here, but the comment was that that the way we practice medicine and the fact that we're team-based has changed the role of the physician in how we practice medicine. And maybe what is in here is that we are much more connected than we ever have been before with the changes in technology. Mally in the back. Right. So there's so I hear two comments there. One is access to information. When I went to medical school, graduated in 1985, you actually got the textbook and you read it, and if you read that textbook, which was with 2 or 3 years up to date, you knew 90% of what there was to know about any discipline, right? And if you needed to go to the journals, you had to go to the library and look things up through Indicus Medicus and then find the journal on the shelf and have it photocopied. Medical information is widely available. The amount of information is growing exponentially, and it's a varying quality, right? So the other comment is how students actually learn. So there is so much information out there, it's no longer possible to teach everything about medicine within a four-year curriculum. We have to teach our medical students how to access that information and how to decide what information is valid and which is relevant to their clinical practice. Any other comments? Anita? Sure. Physicians, patients arrive educated as well, either well educated or not so well educated, based on what information they've read. So we have to prepare our students to be able to deal with the informed patient. Right, so to take that one step further, the patients actually go home and check to make sure that your recommendations and your treatment are valid. So so there's a obligation to, so we have to teach partnership in the doctor-patient relationship or the patient-doctor relationship. And we also have to, I guess, sort of that medical expert role is still valid Maybe one last comment and then we'll move on. Right, so the comment was that physicians need to teach their patients how to access medical information on the internet. So we're talking a lot about technology. Probably the thing that didn't come up was really the genomics, and that which is where the future of medicine and medical care with really genetic targeted treatment of disease. And maybe another comment is that just looking at the world population at 7 billion, it's a very different world. We're not only more interconnected in terms of health professions, but we're also more interconnected nationally and globally. And the effects of, for instance, Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines has a much more direct effect on our own populations here in Montreal. All right, so why new curriculum? Why fix what seems to be working for the last 19 years? There are two driving forces behind this. First, there was a strategic planning exercise that happened at McGill that was led by Rich Levin, which I guess most deans, when they start, they decide on some strategic planning to guide themselves. So that was a Think Dangerously project. It was actually published in 2010. And the other project was the Future Medical Education in Canada project, or FMEC, that was commissioned by the Association of Faculties of Medicine of Canada, that looked at undergraduate and then afterwards a separate postgraduate report. And that also came out in 2010. So those were the two driving forces behind curricular change. And so the Think Dangerously project basically set out to, with a vision that McGill be recognized as Canada's foremost medical undergraduate program, and that we need to prepare future physicians to take their place as leading medical practitioners, educators, and researchers. And it highlighted the values of physicianship, which is an important part of the McGill medicine curriculum, addressing the needs of society and teaching adaptability in this changing world, and also scholarship. The recommendations highlighted there were eight recommendations that came out of this report, that we needed to address society's needs. We need to ensure educational excellence, which is a bit taken for granted. That the teachers of our students should actually have McGill appointments, so that we actually have some control over the quality of teaching, and also some control over the educational environment by which where our students learn. We need to promote lifelong learning. We need to provide an early clinical exposure so that students actually have an idea what they're learning, put the context of what they're learning into, and link it with what their clinical experience will be. We have to counter the hidden curriculum. The hidden curriculum is the messages that students get when they're actually in the hospitals and in the workplace that may be different from what we teach in the medical school. We have to have a central managed curriculum, so that the objectives of the curriculum are determined centrally and that are taught distributedly, and it's not. And rather than us just saying, okay, surgery teach something about surgery, pediatrics teach something about pediatrics, psychiatry teach something about psychiatry. We need to know and make sure that there are no gaps and that we minimize the redundancies. And we also have to promote interprofessional teamwork, and that came up as our first comment. It also described the attributes of the type of graduate that we want to see at the end of our four-year program. So we want to have a graduate that has stage-appropriate clinical expertise, demonstrates the attributes of physicianship, has good communication skills, is able to work as part of a team, has critical thinking, and is able to make decisions based on the information they have beforehand. They're able to adapt to changes in practice, which is only going to happen more so in the future. That they have an understanding of the healthcare system and the role of public health. Yeah. And then the last one is that we, it's sort of scholarship and research. So I was actually going to ask that question. So Celine beat me to it, but I can ask the question again after I go through the FMEC recommendation. So the, I just went backwards. All right, so the Future Medical Education in Canada document came up with also 10 recommendations, and there's some overlap with actually what McGill did. So it just kind of shows that we kind of reinvent the wheel all the time. Everybody sort of does the same thing, comes up with the same conclusions. In some ways, that's validating. In some ways, it's actually a waste of resources and time and work. What we still don't do, as much as we're interconnected, we don't still talk enough to the other universities to find out what they're doing, because all 17 medical schools are going through curricular reform, and we're all doing it our own way. So the recommendations from FMAC is that we need to address individual and community needs. We need to enhance the admissions process so we increase the diversity of the student population, because a diverse population is more likely to, diverse student body is more likely to better serve the diversity of the local population, or in our case, the Quebec context. We have to build on the scientific basis of medicine, that medicine is still based in science. We need to build on that. And I think that was our biggest stumbling block in rebuilding the new curriculum. I think this was taken for granted. And of course, medicine is based in the basic sciences, and we didn't include the basic scientists on the executive committee in terms of restructuring the curriculum, and we got some backlash, and that some of that ended up in the Gazette in the spring. We need to promote prevention and public health. We need to address the hidden curriculum I talked about. We need to diversify the learning context. Our students are still taught mostly in hospitals and less in outpatients, and most of medicine these days happens in the outpatient setting and not in hospitals. So we have to align that somehow. We have to value generalism, and part that means family medicine. In 2017, 55% of postgraduate training spots will be in family medicine. This year it's 50%. So that means that, yes, we do have to promote family medicine. We also have to promote research and clinician scientists, and we have to find a way to do all of that. So you've got to think about that. And if our students all want to do specialties other than family medicine, only 45% will actually find a training position in Quebec at the end of their training, and the other 55% will have to leave the province. So we have to kind of think about that. Right now we're sitting at about 30%, 32%. So there's still a gap. We have to advance inter and interprofessional practice because we work in teams. And we have to have a competency-based and flexible approach to our teaching. I don't think we're quite there yet. We're trying to be more flexible, and we have to foster leadership. So seeing what the recommendations are between FMEC and the McGill graduate, how do you align the admissions process to select students who will be successful in this program, and will not only be successful in this program, but will be successful in postgraduate program and in practice, because out of the postgrad document, recommendation number 5 says that we actually need to integrate transitions along the educational continuum from undergrad to postgrad to practice, but I would say actually that starts with the admissions process. So I will open that up for comments now.
Might be that some changes are actually a little late for us.
Right.
I
think you probably all heard that, but the comment is that for a graduating fourth year student, the feeling was that the current curriculum did not meet the type of medical student that was admitted. And I would actually say that's probably true. I think the admissions process was ahead of the game with the changing towards the MMIs and looking at the other CanMeds competencies other than the medical expert, selected medical students with a much more diverse set of skills, and we had still had a much more traditional curriculum. So we would take a diverse population of medical students, and our very first month was a crash course in molecular biology. So the students who did best were the CEGEP students who had just done 2 years of science in CEGEP, 1 year of university-based science, and the people with more diverse backgrounds or were more distant from their science actually struggled in the first month. So we definitely were not aligned in terms of how we welcome students. Our current block A in the new curriculum, and I'll put that up in a second, is actually a very macro look at what medicine is all about. It's called From Molecules to Global Health, and it takes a case of the week, and it looks at that disease process from a micro level or a cellular level, and also looks at the social determinants of health and the global health implications. And it gives medical students a much better idea of what medicine can be all about. Other comments? So the question is, how do we align McGill's reputation for being leaders in research with generalism and family practice? And the answer, it's difficult. It's one of the tensions, and it's a bit of the tensions between the basic scientists and the curriculum. But we've had to find a way to do both. So we have to actually be able to value generalism. So I actually didn't finish my thought. So generalism means family medicine, but it also means general pediatrics, general internal medicine, general surgery, so that we're actually that the physicians we graduate take care of a bigger part of the whole patient rather than a very tiny, tiny slice. Now, obviously, we need the researchers. So there was an external review of the MD PhD program, which will actually be made public. And there is a recommendation that we actually maybe expand that program a little bit, that we actually create a separate cohort with different competencies that by which those candidates are being assessed. Because having to meet both competencies, the best MD-PhD programs actually are excluded by the admissions process. And so that we actually enhance and make that an elite program. So those are ways to do it, but we have to somehow do both. There is a research research course in medical school now, which never existed before. It's pretty basic, but it will at least expose all students to some research, and hopefully those students will actually continue on to do research.
And there is a proposal as well that will allow and encourage undergraduates to have research component in many of their courses, feeling that that is lacking even in undergraduate.
Right, so the comment is even in undergraduate there's a move to including more research in the education, and there were two comments in the back.
I think there's a concern in our specialty, and I think across subspecialties.
So the right. So it's, again, it's a bit of the tension between family medicine and other specialties, and are we discouraging other specialties by promoting family medicine? And I think that partly goes to the hidden curriculum. We want to promote generalism, and I think part of the problem, McGill, is there hasn't been a really good exposure to family medicine, and there haven't necessarily been. It's improved over the past few years, but if you look at where most medical students train, there's not a lot of family medicine practitioner role models within the MUHC or the Jewish General. St. Mary's is certainly different. So that's part of it. So part of it is exposure and role modeling. But I think we need to promote everything. But also there's also a big concern among residents about having a job at the end of the day, right? So again, we have to make, and medical students are starting to think that way as well when they're applying to CARMS, is if I choose this residency, will I actually have a job at the end of 5 years? I think that's becoming a bigger concern, and I think that's also a reality. So we have to align that.
Disclose that I am a super duper, high intensity, technologically based pediatric subspecialist when I make these comments, okay? I think that sometimes what happens is that there's a dichotomization that goes on there's excellent research that needs to be done to serve the needs of society from the point of view of family medicine. Right, so there's kind of like scholarship that needs to be done there, and there's prestige to our university that can come from these kinds of scholarships. So we need to think that way about things, and just from that disclosure that I just made, I just want to say that I actually think that another message that has to get out is that it's actually harder to deal with undifferentiated symptomatology, actually. That's a hidden curriculum message, right? That's your colleagues telling you, I don't know what specialty you're in, but let's say CVT. That's your colleagues telling you, you need to go away to Melbourne so that you can learn about the left ventricle only, right? You know, versus this idea that let's value the kind of knowledge that comes from dealing with populations that come to us with undifferentiated symptomatology. And I worked in ER and in ICU. I do in both places. And in ER, I was always challenged by the undifferentiated symptomatology that I saw. So I think that those kinds of messages have to come out, and we have to seek those kinds of people who value those kinds of things in our selection process.
There was one more comment, and maybe I'll try wrap up because.
Who did you wanted to go to?
I think you're really looking at a total culture change. For decades, and I've been in healthcare for 45 years, the value was really the specialty, and you were just a GP, and. Now, and what I saw, because I worked at the Vic for gazillion years, there are three specialties that are really, really promoted, that are valued, and if you're in those programs, you know, you're there. You know, you've got CVT or cardiology, you've got transplant, and you've got oncology. And those are the three major forces, and this is where we spend a lot of time and where, you know, that's what people are... come present with if you want. But now what you want is to tell people it's good to be a GP, it's good to be a general surgeon, it's good to be a general whatever. And I'm not sure how you're planning on doing that, because if you just say, okay, these are the boxes we need to fill and you guys have to pick this, that's not a culture change, because people are not going to be happy with that. You know, they have to be excited about being a GP or about being a general surgeon. And that's much more complicated than changing your curriculum.
Absolutely. And in fact, actually, that's a good segue to the rest of my presentation, which I'll finish off. And I guess my comment is actually when you're looking at those three specialties that are valued at the Royal Victoria, I work at the Montreal General. We don't have CVT. We don't have transplant. So, right. So in terms of what if you, you know, as a student who goes to the Royal Victoria is exposed to a very different hidden curriculum than those who go to the General or St. Mary's, and part of that is role modeling and et cetera, right? So that speaks to the hidden curriculum very, very well. So how do you determine this? So and I talked about a centrally managed curriculum. So we decided we'd end up with the end. We already have the characteristics of a graduating medical student from McGill from the Think Dangerously project. So we're building the new curriculum around the Medical Council of Canada clinical presentations, which set out the objectives and the attributes expected of medical graduates. And this is the licensing exam that all medical graduates in Canada take. So we're taking those objectives and we're mapping them back across the curriculum and deciding where they should be taught. So that's a basis. And that means that we can't add to it, but that's the basis of what things are. So we're starting out with the end product and we're trying to build a curriculum to get to the end. So we're paving the road. The parts of the curriculum or components of the curriculum are pretty similar as they were previously with different names. So basis of medicine, the first 18 months is now called Fundamentals of Medicine and Dentistry because dentistry is part of the same curriculum for the first 18 months. Introduction to clinical medicine, the second part of second year is now called Transition to Clinical Practice. And we change that name from Transition to Introduction because students are being introduced to clinical practice in FMD. Clerkship is clerkship, which is the third and fourth year, and then physicianship is still a component, and physician apprenticeship still runs as a separate course. And if you Google MBCM new curriculum, there's a great website. You can look at all kinds of stuff there. Okay. We have taken themes that we've interwoven longitudinally through the curriculum. Many of these come out of the FMEC recommendations, and some of these are homegrown themes that we value, such as diversity, which follows in the admissions equity and diversity theme, and I'll let you, and we have a very well-developed Office of Student Affairs with Namta Gupta as the Assistant Dean, and so we included student wellness and career advising as part of, which hopefully will get students to the right spot at the end. And we have certain interest groups that presented to us that wanted to make sure that their area of interest was well represented in the curriculum, where it may not fit well in certain places. And some of these we've actually, for the most part, we've tried to incorporate these on a longitudinal basis. So we're looking at incorporating some kind of recognition for doing global health activities and electives within what's allowed in the curriculum and providing some kind of a certificate. There's going to be a new medical ethics and health law course that will be partly in second year and partly in fourth year. Palliative care is sprinkled throughout. Social studies of medicine, instead of being in fourth year at the end and a one-month block, is now actually sprinkled throughout. They're actually giving stuff throughout, and we actually have an ultrasound curriculum that extends throughout the 4 years, which is very innovative in preparing students for residency where ultrasound competency is expected. So this is what FMD looks like. It's very much the system blocks that occurred in BOM. The difference is that in second year, which is at the bottom part, in BOM, we used to teach all the normal physiology in first year and all the abnormal in the beginning and pathology in the beginning of second year. This is now all integrated. So when you're learning about asthma, you're not only learning about normal lung function, you're learning about the pathophysiology of asthma, you're learning about the drugs that you used to treat asthma, which only learned in second year. There are four courses that run, the mouse isn't working, but there's four courses that run longitudinally. So physician apprenticeship continues to run with the Osler Fellows. There's now a longitudinal family medicine experience, so every first-year student is paired with a family medicine preceptor in the community, and they have two visits a month with them, so 20 visits over first year. And what we're planning for year two, instead of the longitudinal family medicine experience, is an expansion of our CHAP program, or Community Health Alliance project, which was recognized but voluntary, which will place all students in a community outreach type of activity. There is a research course. First year is really sort of a research methods type thing. This is the possibilities. There's a little paper at the end. And the second year, all students are expected to participate in some kind of research activity and write some short paper on that that experience. That may include the summary bursary program that about half the class actually do. And then we have a clinical methods course that teaches students how to take medical histories and physical examination, and they're aligned with the system. So they learn about the respiratory exam and the respiratory block, about the cardiovascular exam and the cardiovascular block, and when they visit, their family medicine preceptors are actually able to put that into practice with real patients. So we're actually now in circulation in November. We've successfully gone through the first two blocks, and amazingly, people have taught up and people have shown up and taught, and nobody's actually not shown up to teach a class. And we've run a couple of exams, and things seem to be going pretty well. So, and knowing what's coming up for the rest of the year, we're definitely fine through the end of the year. And we're looking now ahead at transition to clinical practice, which is the preclinical phase where we get students in the hospital and we introduce them to patients at the bedside. There's some reorganization of what's been there previously. And we've tried to change the names a bit. So we have internal medicine and neurology together in an 8-week block. We have surgery, anesthesia, radiology, and ophthalmology together in another 8-week block. And then we have probably the newest block, family medicine, pediatrics, I would say. And then the medical ethics and health law course will run in there, as well as some public health. Currently, there's been, like, when you do your 3 weeks of surgery, you have an exam at the end of 3 weeks of surgery, and all the students are kind of are doing their 3 weeks at different times. We're running exams all the time. And there's an exam at the end of 1 week of ophthalmology. What we're planning is actually a comprehensive exam at the end of the block, so that we're actually examining things at an integrated model, so that we provide the links and it's not all separate and parceled out. And clerkship, we have an integrated clerkship in Gatineau that's been running for now into its fourth year, and it's actually been a very good experience. We've learned lots about it, and our clerkship is also going to be much more integrated. So I think integrated is the word for the curriculum. So we've put medicine and surgery together so that surgical problems don't exist outside of the medical issues of the patient. We've put women and child health together, so we're putting the mother and the child, and we're putting family medicine and mental health together. And these will be 16-week blocks, and that'll actually allow for a 16-week longitudinal external experience in clinics where actually students will be able to see patients more than once over a 16-week period. So that's how what we're planning. All this, the details are still happening, but hopefully this will actually get us to the end in terms of where the objectives. And in fourth year, students are off doing electives and they're preparing for CARM's match. So this is much more traditional type of structure, and there will be still a core geriatric medicine 4-week experience, an emergency medicine 4-week experience, and a new public health selective where students will pick from a series of public health clinics which may be aligned to what their future interest of practice is. We're going to go back to the old curriculum for the end of the year, partly from experience. Once CARMS happens, students are somewhat disengaged from the clinical experience, so having a clinical month in March is actually not that effective. So we're going to actually have a seminar series which expands on the basis of medicine that sort of existed in the past and still exists a little bit. And we're going to have a new introduction to residency course that we're calling Transitions that will help prepare students for entry into resident practice. And it's transitions through practice, transitions through reflection, and transitions through, I always forget what the third one is. And we're looking for a course director for that. So if anybody's interested, let me know. And I've gone way over time, so questions? So the question was about the elective experience. So currently students have 20 weeks of electives, 4 weeks in first year, third year, which will still exist, okay, and then 16 weeks in fourth year. We're basically taking that clinical block out of March, which really doesn't count towards CARMS. So in terms of the elective experience before CARMS comes out, there's actually going to be no change. We do allow 2 and 3 week electives. We require students to have electives in 3 different disciplines so that they diversify their portfolio a little bit, so that they may be attractive to more than one specialty, or that if they change their mind about what they want to do in July or August of fourth year, which has actually happened a few times this year, and all of a sudden students have to redo their whole elective plan for the fall, that it's less of a change. So why is geriatrics not included in internal medicine? So the reason for keeping, so geriatrics currently exists in the fourth year block. In Gatineau, it's actually done longitudinally in third year. We decided to keep emergency medicine geriatrics separately because they're two disciplines that actually are, there's fairly undifferentiated. They actually build on a lot of the experiences that you get in clerkship. So it's actually, they're more integrative in terms of problem solving. And geriatrics, particularly, not that that does not happen in other disciplines, is a chance for applying some of the interprofessional aspects and the teamwork. It's sort of the model. It's the model for, I think geriatrics is one of the models for interprofessionalism, but it certainly exists elsewhere and it will be highlighted elsewhere. Right. So the question is that part of learning any discipline is being integrated in the team and being implicated in patient care. And how is that going to happen when you're now mixing medicine and surgery? So even when you look at Gatineau, there is still block time on the surgical ward or on the internal medicine ward. So out of that 16 weeks, you may spend 3 weeks on the internal medicine ward and 3 weeks on the surgery ward, and you may do 2 weeks of eMERGE consults. So there will still be block time within that, and the students will be working on different schedules. But the advantage of integrating it is that there will be some opportunities for common things. So, for instance, pre-op clinic, which could be shared between medicine and surgery, the neonatal nursery that could be shared between obstetrics and pediatrics, and the fact that you actually have 16 weeks where you can actually be in the same clinic week to week, and so that you might actually be able to see your patient pre-op, maybe be there at the surgery and see them post-op, which actually would never happen here, or that you might actually be able to follow your patient in clinic when you discharge them from the internal medicine ward, or that when you start somebody on antihypertensive therapy that you actually can see them again and see what effect your therapy has had. Okay, so two last comments, and then we need to wrap up. So I think I hear two things in that question. One is, have we taken student feedback into account in planning the curriculum? And the other thing is, what about the rotations that are very difficult? So I'll answer the second one first. There actually are accreditation standards on workload, and we actually monitor workload through the rotation evaluations, and it's one of the accreditation things, benchmarks that we are following, and we are enforcing workload policies, which right now is at 60 hours a week, and that we might try to bring down to 55, but we are monitoring, and when there is a where there's a flag, we actually intervene with the rotation, and we actually have done that successfully. So that's number one. I think that's separate from this, but it's obviously related. And there are students involved on every single planning committee for the new curriculum, including the executive. So yes, students have actually input into the design of this, of the curriculum. Okay, last comment. So the question is about evaluation, which is actually a very good question. In fact, you should actually think about evaluation almost before you design your curriculum. Currently, because we don't have very good in-house exams, we're using shelf exams by the National Board of Emergency of Medical Education in the States for internal medicine and surgery and stuff like that. We are working on the evaluation. We will probably, we may have an opportunity to be able to pick and choose the questions from the NBME bank, which we're actually exploring right now, which actually might give us the questions that are best. We're worried that actually with the new curriculum that the shelf exams will be less aligned to the objectives, and they may actually not be a valid evaluation tool. But what is planned is a comprehensive evaluation at the end of TCP, so there would be an OSCE at the end of TCP, at the end of clerkship, and the end of fourth year, so that there will be more comprehensive and integrative evaluations. And on that note, I am leaving.
Just So thank you very much. we are a little bit behind, but we will take a 5-minute break. I was reflecting as Rob was talking about the changes to learning, because I am from the textbook age as well. We aren't quite at the time when it was Harrison's principle of internal medicine. But we do both go quite far back, and there really have been a lot of changes to medical education that really our curriculum and our selection process needs to adapt to. So take a 5-minute break, come back, and we're going to do very quickly update from the committees, and then one MMI simulation.